And the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is that to excuse my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy."
It's wonderful today to be celebrating the baptism of two new Christians who are much loved in our congregation. It does feel, though, having to preach a sermon on Job, like being the bad fairy at Sleeping Beauty's christening. But I'm hoping that I'm going to give you some words of encouragement from our passage today, and a mythbuster. So who is Job? As we've heard in the last two sermons, he's a righteous, upright man whose wealth and prosperity are a direct result of his good behavior. But he is struck down by total disaster, and he loses everything. Now, Job can't understand why this has happened to him. He rails against God, and he questions God's justice during his long, long, long conversations with his friends. But he keeps his faith in God. Now, Job's friends come as comforters, and they tell him, "You have obviously done something wrong. You may say you're innocent, but you've clearly done something wrong, and you now deserve your punishment." And to be fair, that's exactly what Job thought before he was struck down. So Job questions focus on his undeserved suffering, and he's constantly trying to prove his innocence, as if he's on trial. But is it Job or God on trial? God is incensed by Job's questions. Job has been goading God to appear so Job can plead his case before God and win. And now God appears out of a storm. What follows is a series of ironical questions from God, which underline the huge gap between divine and human creativity and understanding. But what God doesn't do, by the way, is accuse Job of wrongdoing, and he never mentions Job's complaints. Job has brought God's plans and justice into question, and now God accuses Job of having no knowledge of what God's plans are. Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? After this initial rebuke, God seeks to clarify the meaning of the divine plan by describing very beautifully all his actions in creation. And his words are very reminiscent of Genesis and of Psalm 8. He delights in the beauty and diversity of his creation, a creation which he has made freely out of his love. So God tells Job to brace himself like a man, for he's now going to question Job, and Job is going to have to answer. No, first question. Where were you, Job, when I was laying the foundation of the earth? Well, Job isn't going to get a point there, is he? Second question. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. You seem to know absolutely everything, Job. And so it goes on and on. God asking questions about creation that Job can't possibly answer. But there are some wonderful little details. If you read on in the chapter, it's really worthwhile having a look at it, because there are wonderful little things that God does. For instance, God asks Job, "Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wonder about the lack of food?" I couldn't help thinking as I read these chapters that I really had never thought about all these minute details of God's creation. It was like having a David Attenborough experience when you see the world as it is for the very first time, and you see how marvelous, how awesome, how beyond my comprehension it is, and beyond Job's comprehension. So how does Job respond to all these questions? Well, you're going to have to wait till next week when Ian's sermon will tell us what Job has to say. But with our limited human knowledge, and indeed mine, what are we to make of Job's speech? Does he answer Job's questions? Well, does it tell us something about the nature of God? I think it tells us that God is free to create what he likes, when he likes, out of love. God's response to Job is to show him how freely out of love, for no gain, God has created a world far more complex and beautiful than any human can understand. We don't have the knowledge, even now in the 21st century with all our discoveries. We weren't there when God laid the foundations of the world. We can't send lightning bolts. God seemingly creates some things for absolutely no reason at all. I mean, why send rain in the uninhabited desert, which God does? He does it for the joy of it, for the joy of creation, and not necessarily for the benefit of human beings. God is also telling Job that God's creation is not all about Job. It's not all about him. It's not all about us. He challenges Job to reshape his view of creation from God's perspective. Well, what question would God ask us about our nurture and stewardship of the earth's resources? Do we love the earth as God does? Or are we causing destruction of the natural world for our own selfish consumerist culture? You can be sure that God wants an answer. Secondly, God has a plan for creation. Job and his friends were sure they knew God's plan and system of justice for the world. Really simple. You get a reward if you're good, you get punished if you're bad. This they regarded as the reason for God's work, and therefore all actions in history will take this foreseeable and predictable path. But God tells Job that he has a plan, but he challenges Job's knowledge of his plan because he wasn't there. God's plan requires knowledge which would show Job that the key to understanding the universe is not based on some sort of vengeful justice. You do good and I'll reward you, you do bad, I'll punish you. But love. In the beginning, God's plan for creation was based on freely given divine love. Love, not retribution, is the cornerstone on which our world is built. And God is present. Job has accused God of being absent, but finally God appears. Job has had an intense experience of suffering. His emotions have ranged from anguish and despair to glimmers of hope. And out of the experience, he has this extraordinary revelation of God. God has not been absent. He has been beside Job, listening all the time. So does God appear to us? Does God appear to us in our times of despair? And how do we know? We long to hear his still small voice of calm. So what was really lovely today is to hear from our baptismal candidates how God has spoken to them, how Alex felt God calling him, and how Sam felt God's presence. For some, that is what happens. One friend of mine told me that she'd suffered a serious debilitating illness for years, which confined her to bed. One night, she experienced an extraordinary sense of power of God hovering over her. So overwhelming, so comforting, so powerful, that she didn't dare move for hours afterwards. She knew God was with her. In the deepest darkness of our lives, God is present within the darkness. God is not absent in pain and suffering. And maybe God talks through other people. When I had the worst year of my life, when my brother, aged 44, died after a long struggle with serious debilitating mental and physical health, and my 21-year-old son nearly died after two operations, I couldn't hear God. Like Job, I wanted to know why. Why my brother? Why my son? Why am I suffering as a mother? But I did experience love and the constant support from friends. Particularly in church, I had one friend who had an adult child with chronic health conditions, who understood what it was like to nurse a sick, very sick child. from another woman whose disabled teenage child had died, which is really unbearable as a parent, and from the vicar who anointed me after a service as the tears were streaming down my face. God showed up, not in a storm, but in his love, reflected in the love and the compassion of people around me who were prepared to engage with my distress. Are we prepared to turn up for other people in distress? We are Christ's hands and feet. He has no body now on earth except ours. You may not think of yourself as God's agent, but you are. We all are. And talking to God, you may think Job has been exceptionally bold, in fact rude, possibly even blasphemous in his speeches, but he kept talking until God appeared. If nothing else, the book of Job shows the importance of talking to God, saying whatever it is that's on your heart, the good, the bad, and the very bad. God wants us to communicate with him through prayers, even our prayers of accusations, of fear and despair. God is present. He is here. His spirit is with us. But his answer to prayer might not be what you expected. So I said at the beginning that this beautiful passage encourages us. It encourages us to look again at the world around us and marvel at our beautiful world. It encourages us to know that God created the world out of love. Love for the small things, like ravens. Love for the stars, the earth, and love for humankind. It encourages us to know that God is listening to us. He is not absent. He may appear in a storm. He may appear in a whisper in your ear, a tap on the shoulder, the acts of charity and compassion of other people, and the Mythbuster. God has a plan for the world which is based on love, not on retribution and punishment. It is too simple to say that God blesses the good with material wealth and status and punishes the wicked with lack of wealth and status. That is not what we observe in everyday life. We all have friends and relations and ourselves who suffered poor health and maybe died at a young age. We all know good people who have suffered, and those who we judge wicked have prospered. In the end, we don't have enough knowledge to understand God's plan. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have one and that it's not good. In the end, we have to put our faith in God and trust that he hears our cries of joy and sorrow and listen.